Hopefully I'll just start that. Good. Yes, thank you. Right, hi everybody. So this is going to be kind of black sky thinking, right? All the way out of the box, all the way to the other side of the field, all the way into things which may never happen, but probably will. So let's start at the very beginning. Right? It's a talk about foreign policy in an environment where you have no state, or at least a post-state environment. And we were talking about doing this over the network because it's the only thing that you have in the non-state environment that has any real durability. And I really mean this as a foreign policy initiative. Right now, we have all this network activism and all this network activity. What we don't have is any real sense of an ability to transact business at the same level that governments do, even though we're essentially providing services at the same level. So if you think of something like Wikipedia, Wikipedia is doing exactly the same job as UNESCO, only instead of having a budget of, I don't know, half a billion a year, it's got a budget of 5 million a year. This is foreign policy without a state. And we're going to go all the way down this rabbit hole and find some weird stuff at the bottom. Sound like fun? Oh, wrong way. Okay, so, start at the beginning, right? We normally think in very constrained ways about what's happening to us in the future. And if you don't think in constrained ways, essentially you run into transhumanist territory really, really quickly, because it's quite late in the 21st century in a lot of ways. So there's this kind of middle ground, which is a little awkward, between business as usual foreign policy and transhumanism. And we're in this kind of middle ground. So if you have transhumanist concerns that are not addressed here, that's because we can't touch the transhumanist stuff and remain visible to anything resembling the mainstream. I do acknowledge that it is there. Right. So that is a quick background for me. Bottom line is, started in tech, wandered into policy, still in policy. Best known for this thing, the Hexier. And I'm just going to blast through this because most of you have probably seen it before. That is a Hexier. That is a whole sheet of 4x8 in the same way that it comes off a truck. It's just plywood. You can use anything else. Roof pieces are half sheets. You can also make honking great big domes. Big 45 square meter structure. No need for spherical trigonometry, designed by a mathematician called Edmund Harris. Shelter is easy. What you get out of that, if you really take the bull by the horns and run with it, is the reason the financial system is collapsing over and over and over again is because housing is the last truly inefficient global industry. So houses cost £250,000 for a machine that you could construct in a factory for 20 grand and have change left over. But because we assemble these things by hand, because every single one is different, because they lack effective modularity, they're incredibly expensive, and there are huge entrenched monopolies that prevent us getting into a position where housing is cheap again. It's an enormous racket.
Lack of space, though, isn't
it? Not everywhere. Lack of space here in a handful of cities in the world, but for everybody else, it's purely a housing technology question. Hexier itself has been around since 2002. The reason it spreads so slowly is it's a 100% viral spread project. We don't use money to accelerate it because we want the thing to be like a cockroach, unkillable, a change that cannot be reversed because there's no way to defund it. Massively present at Burning Man, right? There's satellite pictures. We reckon they're building between 1 and 2,000 hexyards a year at Burning Man, net outlay between $1 and $2 million. And they're just everywhere. They've become standard. Something like 10% of burners are in them. Anyway, that's where I came from. What about you lot? Right? It's not that often that you get to talk to a room full of people that have actually legitimately changed the world. Right? The Bitcoin community as a whole has affected real global change. Well done. Right? You know, other groups that could make that claim, maybe Wikipedia, maybe Linux, not that many. Certainly almost none of the political groups, right? Compared to, say, the Green Party or the NGOs. You guys actually solved the problem you went out to solve. But, right, the problems continue. Everybody's in this kind of libertarian rhetorical frame because it came along with Bitcoin at the beginning. Many of you will have libertarian politics. The bad news is that libertarian politics are completely chocolate teapot useless in the world we actually live in. Because even if you can sort out some of this concentration of power stuff, you're still left with the fact that the economic base that you operate on is driven by slavery. So all of the computers that we're using to run all this free software on are manufactured by people in China who don't vote, who are under constant surveillance, who have very few political rights and who can't unionize to negotiate a fair price for their labor.
So exactly the same as
people? Well, exactly the same as the people in the UK a couple of hundred years ago. A lot of the stuff that we fought for here in terms of changes to the industrial law are still to be done in China. Right? There were real victories. Some of my ancestors down there got lynched for their work on that stuff. The world that we're in is really, really problematic. Right? If we had a country that had the same dynamics as the world as a whole, we would think of it as being a place like North Korea, not a place like America. Right? Seventh of the population in constant hunger, millions of people starving to death a year. If the entire world was a single country, that country would be a basket case. It would be in the worst third. And we have a very distorted model of this, because the 1% line, what makes you a member of the 1%, globally speaking, is an annual income of $35,000 a day, or about £25,000. Right? We are a super elite group looking out at the world saying, you know, we'd like this to be a little flatter and a little fairer, but actually beneath us is the other 98% of humanity who are looking at us like, you bastards, how did you get all that money? And the answer, of course, is colonialism is how we got that money. Right? We got that money because we stole it, fair and square. Right? UK has invaded, what, 140 of the countries in the world?
Yeah.
Something like that? Unbelievable. Land piracy. So most of the rhetoric around things like Bitcoin is about upward progress on the pyramid. Right? We want to basically dismantle the monopolies at the head end of society with the objective of making some of their wealth our wealth. But, oh, by the way, this is for a video which is really worth watching. Juice Wrap, Guide to the New World Order. It's hilarious. That's the problem with moving up the pyramid. Right? It doesn't matter how far up the pyramid you get, you're still going to be subject to climate, you're still going to be subject to resource war, you're still going to be subject to fascism. Right? There's really no way out by clambering up to the top end of a sinking ship. You have to get down to the engine room and stop the ship sinking. It's a much, much more difficult problem than getting up the pyramid, but it also promises actual solutions. Right? Bitcoiners collectively, the crypto community collectively, actually has the power to change the way the world works in a real way. You've done it once with a set of political ethics that turn out to have very little leverage on the real problems of the world. There is no reason that you couldn't do it again or modify the work already done to actually get leverage on the real problems. Because right now, fundamentally, whether Bitcoin succeeds or fails is going to make zero difference to global poverty and zero difference to global warming. It does not have leverage. And it's a shame to see so much effort and so much political power going into a set of causes which are irrelevant to the global situation, even if they succeed. Irrelevant even if it succeeds is a really bad category. So, right, this is the lever. The lever is what is going to happen to the world in the next 10 years is roughly what would have happened to 13th century Europe if everybody had been handed a smartphone. Right? I mean, if you think about the centuries of war that were produced by the printing press and the total transformation in quality of life, that was radical stuff. Things like that, but vastly more radical, are coming very, very soon all over the developing world. Right now, we've got on the order of 2 billion internet users. The vast majority of internet users are rich and white. Right? 10 years from now, we will have probably somewhere between 5.5 and 6 billion internet users. More or less every adult will be on the internet, and the internet will overwhelmingly be made of dirt poor brown and black people, because that's what the world is overwhelmingly made of. And we're going to see a complete destruction of the class and privilege structure associated with the internet. The majority of internet users will be poor peasants talking to each other in languages we don't even know the names of, discussing the problems that they're having growing cassava. And that world is coming extremely quickly, and with it, unbelievable discontinuous change. it's more or less impossible to buy dumb phones anymore. Once you've got smartphones, the entire network opens, and once the network opens, the games begin. This is happening right now. Has anybody seen the Mozilla phones? $40 smartphone with the entire interface built in JavaScript. Battery life is incredible, excellent web browser, incredibly robust, practically free. Anybody can afford one. So, what have we gotten done so far? We have this central bank of the internet thing, and it is astonishing, right? Now that you have a central bank and you've got an identity issuing service in as much as identity equals key pair, you begin to get into a position where you're providing for people many of the same services that the state has traditionally provided for them. And this is an enormous reservoir of untapped political power that could be used to do things like defend the crypto community from the people that would quite like us to stop the stuff we're doing. Because if you are being astonishingly useful to 3 billion poor people, it's very hard to turn you off without looking like a genocidal maniac. So the poor are not going to remain stuck in the position that we think of them as being stuck in. Right? The notion that if you're a villager and you're a farmer, you really don't have any options other than continuing to grow vegetables is being rapidly eroded by massive technological fixes. Right? Ultra-cheap solar panels, mesh networking, cryptocurrencies, the Sawyer filter. It's a little widget about maybe this size, which will purify 100,000 gallons of water and take out all bacteria for $20. The big one is the size of a Coke can and it'll do 1 million gallons, including viruses, for $100. Functionally speaking, clean water is now a soluble problem. And this is true for almost all of the traditional things which make poverty an unacceptable lifestyle. You've got a set of tech fixes, many of which came out of camping, believe it or not. And if you apply that set collectively, you can get essentially first world levels of infrastructure in any village anywhere in the world. Absolutely game-changing and doable on realistic budgets. You could buy the stuff, and people are doing it. Solar lights have displaced kerosene all over Africa. I did a project on that a couple of years ago for Pakistan, 100,000 solar lights in Pakistan, people love them. So, here's the first hard question, right? Okay, we admit, fine, all of these poor people are going to get onto the internet, it'd be nice to do something. Who wants to have 3 billion clients with an average budget of something like $1,000 a year? Which, by the way, is middle class for the poor, right? Well, the answer is, if you've got really deeply automated systems, you can actually do business at that level and everything still works. You can actually make it pay at those kind of levels. And as a result, you can do business where Visa can't because Visa requires hardcore identity credentialing because Visa's fundamental business model is that they insure transactions. It's nothing to do with moving money, it's everything to do with insurance. And you can't insure risks when you can't get identity. So the crypto community as a whole is almost certainly going to wind up owning the namespace for the very poor. Right? You bind to the phone because of the crypto keys that are on the phone. You bind to the identity because of the user accounts that people make. You wind up having the only index of the very poor that exists, which means you're the only person that can represent them or sell services to them. You could suggest that Facebook would do that. I don't think Facebook is going to have the reach. I think you need crypto and Facebook can't deploy it. Now, let me just check time. Not too bad. Right. So, the mechanisms that you put into place affect the set of transactions which get done. So, if you don't have a position where you can accept Visa, you're going to wind up with a different set of customers than if you do. And the way that markets respond to relatively small steers on this stuff has radical effects. The consequence of this is that you're going to wind up with multiple simultaneous markets in most of the areas that actually matter. Right? The whole notion that it's fundamentally about a single global dominant force, I think, is very unlikely. What we're going to see, for reasons that I'll explain in a second, is a plurality of different marketplaces which are good for different things, in the same way that Ricardian advantage in classical economics says that the people who are good at producing wine should make wine and the people who are good at producing metal should make metal. Right? The same is true in marketplaces. So if you think of the world as many, many, many tiers of interlocking marketplaces, What comes out of that is this notion that you can have a smooth transmission of different markets from the rich to the poor as a series of overlapping systems. It's not, I think, that we're going to see a single global standard that is all things to all people. It's going to be a plethora of smaller games that interoperate. And I think that's good news for everybody. It's not a fight to the finish. If you only have a single currency, only the transactions which are effective to be done with that transaction cost landscape can be managed. So if all you've got is US dollars and you need to pay for something over the internet and you don't have a credit card, you're stuck. You need to add additional payment mechanisms. And right now, it's pretty obvious that, you know, most of your developing world customers for crypto are going to wind up with a set of simple choices. Local fiat currency, Bitcoin, Ethereum-style smart contracts or other smart contract vendors, extraterritorial dollars, presumably through things like dodgy credit cards from Estonia. There's also a whole bunch of local stuff that you can do. MakerFox is a thing for doing local commerce by identifying loops. So everybody basically posts what they want to sell and what they want to buy, and it identifies economic circuits or economic networks so that you can have a transaction in which nobody winds up any richer or any poorer, but everybody gets what they want. Technically, it's called network barter, and it uses enormous chunks of computing power on Amazon to identify the maximally optimal set of trades. But it's only really practical in a place where you're going to be moving the stuff around by hand or for services delivered over the internet. There's also Ian Grigg's Ricardo stuff. That's Ian Grigg right there with the camera. which is a very clever way of using cryptocurrencies to do accounting for people that want to work together at the village level but don't trust each other enough to share a bank account. It's a really clever idea. And the reason that you want to do some of this stuff at a small scale locally rather than just relying on enormous global platforms is about political control. The closer you go to the center of the wheel, the more power you have over the political structures that support you. This is part of a political model called stacktivism, which is all about understanding how the ownership of infrastructure defines political power. So, how high up the curve is it possible for the poor to get? Right? You've got effective currencies through your cell phone, your kids are getting educated with free content on your tablet, you're charging everything with solar panels on the roof, you've got tons and tons and tons of improvement in agriculture because you've actually learned how to farm properly, and there are prototypes from an outcome for 1 acre fund showing doubled agricultural productivity with a 1 year training course. Water is now pure. Malaria is still a bit of a problem, but hopefully somebody will get either a vaccine or those anti-mosquito lasers. You begin to see that there's the potential for quite a high standard of living among the poor without them becoming more dependent on centralized infrastructure or the national grids to do it. And this, I think, is the real frontier of freedom. It's villagers that are food self-sufficient with a shopping bag of technology using decentralized services because they're off the grid, autonomous, have outright ownership of their land, and are very substantially politically free. Because it's so expensive to police them that it's just not worth sending out somebody in a truck. Does that sound kind of like fun? Right. What about the policy stuff, right? If we're going to be building platforms to support 3 or 4 billion people pulling themselves out of poverty and into the global markets, can we do that without getting clobbered? And I think the answer is yes. I think, in fact, it's probably the only way for the crypto community to avoid getting clobbered. Because, again, if you are helping the poor out of poverty, it becomes politically unacceptable to wallop you. Whereas if you're putting Wall Street out of jobs, Wall Street will eventually figure out how to get you. It's a case of becoming part of the global system. Doing the work that the global system is too stupid, greedy, and lazy to do, and doing it because it gives us most of our political objectives and it helps a ton of people. And this is a proper devil's bargain, right? What it will come down to is the ability to create something which looks like sovereignty, but it has no center. So you wind up building a legal system around things like escrow, and from that legal system you get the ability to do global trade between people that don't share a jurisdiction other than the network that they're operating in. So if I'm a web designer in Bolivia and I want to sell services to somebody that lives in Angola, in all probability the only mechanism for doing that is going to be these cryptocurrency networks. And there's every reason to believe that if you are managing a lot of that kind of trade and doing dispute resolution within it, you are now essentially a para-state entity, doing much like the same things the UN is doing. And I think that there's an enormous amount of reach by taking that kind of guerrilla globalism and pushing it all the way to the edges of the map as soon as the network will allow. Alliances, right? The only way to get through this kind of systemic transformation is to partner with the least evil set of existing incumbent power holders and cut a deal. Because if we go out there entirely in rebellious mode with no friends, the existing powers will find a way of closing over us. You want to take a situation which is kind of 51-49, pick the least evil people you can find and get on with, and then put your weight on the side of it which will tip it. All political progress is incumbents cooperating with newcomers, and it's that laminate of a new power and an old power working together that ensures political change. As a movement, the crypto community has to figure out who of the existing powers are our friends. Because right now the answer is basically nobody. And that makes us extremely exposed in the long run. We have to find incumbents to protect us. Raise your money and you take your choice. That was it. Thank you very much. So there's a bunch of links here, and I'll put the slides up pretty much when I go home this evening, so you can get the links off there too. We got time for a couple of questions. I will then repeat the question so it goes on the tape. Who's first? Do you want to come forward to ask or just yell? Questions? No questions at all? Okay, that was easy. Yeah, okay.
Waves of the current of the people who are not currently on the internet. Do you see that there's a challenge there potentially in terms of actually who provides access to the internet, or do you think that internet access itself is actually what we need?
Well, so 3G access is already common over most of the planet. It's just that people generally can't afford it very easily. The stuff for the high bandwidth networking that Google and Facebook are talking about doing. My gut feeling is that they're going to get forced into net neutrality by public opinion in the UN. So although they'll be providing the internet because it increases their customer base, I don't think they're going to wind up being able to do massive locking of the internet in the process, particularly in a post-Snowden environment. I don't think the international community will let it go. But we'll wait and see. Plus, don't forget mesh networking. If you do mesh networking, instead of using Wi-Fi frequencies, you use some of the stuff that used to be used for analog television, you get 15 megabits at 6 kilometers with affordable hardware, and that is a real game changer. That sounded like it was the first part of two questions. What was the second?
The other is, I guess, if you're looking at the difference between the public internet and the internet public, I mean, you'll see this with media policy on the internet or social media or whatever, is that when you talk about the dawn of a new civilization, there's actually something very uncivilized very quickly about public discourse on the internet. So how do you actually keep this new civilization civil?
I don't think there's any realistic hope that it will be civil. So the question was, how do you keep this new civilization civil? The answer is there's no way it's going to be civil. Like Rwanda, the genocide ran off the back of essentially radio. And I don't think we should expect this to be an entirely peaceful transition process, because where there is violence, people will use things like Google Maps to organize their violence more effectively. Nothing we can do, I don't think. Any more questions? Yeah, at the back? You're going to have to yell, I can't hear you. The answer is that diversity in architecture is advice for those that can afford their houses to be sculptures rather than machines. How are we doing for time? Yeah, okay. Yep.
Setting aside the concepts of solving issues of clean water and heat, light, and things, which are all very good ideas, is poverty actually solvable, or is it simply a relative description?
Okay, so the question is poverty actually soluble? I think that we've completely misunderstood how to measure poverty. The only two numbers that I generally pay attention to are infant mortality and length of life. And if you just deal with those two numbers, you discover weird things like areas of Glasgow, which have the same stats as areas of the Congo. Right? Once you begin to frame poverty in those kind of terms, rather than thinking of it as just being about cash flow, you get a much better representation of people who are, say, self-sufficient on their own land, who in cash terms are very poor, but in lifespan are actually doing quite well. In particular, there's a place in India called Kerala where they've got a dollar a day average income and a life expectancy of mid-70s, 95% literacy. You know, they've completely broken the idea that you need cash flow to have essentially a high standard of living. And once you begin to decouple the idea of income from poverty, I think you get much more political freedom to design new ways of solving problems. But I think it is a language problem. We need to actually decouple these concepts and start talking about excess mortality rather than deficient cash flow. All right, done?
Thank you very much.
Lovely. Thank you, everyone.
Two more speakers tonight. I think we will keep rolling rather than having a break, but if you do need to leave, just come back and come back. Next up for some more deep thoughts is Brett Scott.
Get you to stop.
Fabulous.